This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.
You want me to do the intro?
Yeah, go for it. Knock yourself out. Not literally, because then I'll have to do the intro.
Greetings, listeners. This is me, James McLean, and my bag of salt and vinegar twirls. Joining me and my bag of salt and vinegar twirls for this podcast with a K, where we'll be commentarying, which we need a better verb than that, the Christmas Invasion with Christian Calling, editor of things. And hello. I don't really know what he does. I don't really listen.
I don't know what I do either.
I don't know. Brian, who's another thing, who is on that large landmass thing over there. He's here too. And we're about to do, yeah, that's, see? It does the noises. We're going to do a commentary on top of the Christmas Invasion, which was Christmas 2005, what was
yep.
it? Was it 2005? So essentially the idea is whether you've got your Netflix or you've got your DVD, whatever, we'll count you down, you'll sync in with us and you can watch it with us. Or if you don't have it, you can listen to us. We'll try and keep things broad. So if you don't, you know, not watching it precisely, I'm sure the conversation will drag itself off into dribble as it normally does. So sit back and just enjoy what we're about to do. Try and enjoy what we're about to do. Do your best. And we will do our most mediocre. Okay, so are you ready? On 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So yeah, it's going to be very, very rough since we've all probably got it at slightly different syncs.
Oh, I forgot it started like this.
They always all started like this, didn't they?
Yeah, it's like Apes Rose, doesn't it? It's going back to that same.
But didn't End of Time do it as well?
Oh, there you've got me there.
I could be wrong. It was a long time ago now.
I thought for some reason Smith and Jones might have done it as well, but yeah, I'm having difficulty remembering.
Do you ever wonder what was in those presents?
It was bound to be chocolate.
Well, but yeah, what chocolate? And if you're getting into the universe, what are these things? Don't you ever think that? You know, who wrote those cards on the wall? Whose car is in the workshop? No?
What were those cables doing up there?
It's a good opening, this.
That's a health and safety risk, having cables hung up like that, isn't it? There's a suicide risk.
I like this. I remember liking this a lot, this opening. We've said this before. I always thought I'd love to have done as an opening to Doctor Who's Return if it'd been me. But I'd have done it bigger scale than this, but this is still fun.
I like the fact that they didn't just rely on CGI for this opening. There's at least one practical effect in it, and I like that.
It was like the really bottom half of a box, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's a little, I mean, watching it again, yeah, obviously it's a little bit more CGI than I guess what would happen nowadays, but it still works. It's still a good intro.
Yeah.
And a good scene for David. Actually, a good scene for all three of them. It's played well.
It's a shame, actually, because he'd have probably quite rocked that jacket. I like him in that.
It is funny. It is one of those things when, perhaps it's the first time, I guess, I could say, that a new doctor coming in looks as normal in the past doctor's clothes as the original guy.
Yes.
And then you kind of have like this feeling like they could have gone that direction with the show. Like that's how you know the doctor, by what he's wearing, you know, like that staple outfit.
Yeah.
Although I thought Peter Davison looked pretty good in Tom Baker's last outfit, actually.
Oh, yeah. I remember being quite excited by this. I'd not seen him in Casanova, so I had no expectations on Tenant. So the ending to Parting of the Ways was really exciting to me because I felt that sort of feel of Tom Baker there.
I hadn't seen Blackpool or Casanova, but I did remember him from Reeves and Mortimer's Randall and Hopkirk.
Oh, right.
Which is in the first episode, yeah. So I was interested to see. I was surprised, you know, when we first see him that he wasn't Scottish. Remember that? He wasn't Scottish.
Who'd have thought that Billy Piper would have gone from pop star to Doctor Who companion to playing constant sex workers? But it's an odd career path. You would never have predicted back then. But yeah, so I mean, it's funny because this episode, and obviously Moffat does it as well, but you can feel there's a lot of love to the old series in it. You know, these sort of scenes which sort of mirror a little bit of Spear from Space, you know, the pajamas and the two hearts. She never says no to that point of whether he has two of anything else. She just tells her to leave her alone. Are you guys going to say anything? I'm trying
just,
not to.
No.
I'm just, you know, I'm thinking one of the reasons we're watching this, isn't it? Because James and I were talking about it in a podcast a couple of weeks ago. I'd been looking at how Cast Jarvis looked 10 years ago, and on there was an editorial that I'd written on around the 31st of December following this. And there was so much excitement about the whole thing. An excitement that was almost tangible by modern day standards. And I know an excitement can't actually be tangible because it's not physical. But I'm pretty sure you're appreciating what I'm saying. And I'm just watching it with a kind of fascination at really how accomplished it is and how grounded in the real world it is, despite everything that's happened so far.
Yeah. Yeah.
Camille Cajoury is excellent as Jackie, and she feels like someone who lives next door.
Well, that's it. I mean, there was definitely when in 2010 a movement towards. Well, at first it felt like fairy tales, but still, that sort of notion that what you're watching is obviously not real. There was no sort of feeling that it was meant to be grounded in trying to, I don't know, negotiate the sort of feeling real with the fantastical. And I think Davis was really trying that with the characters, or maybe he didn't even have to try. Maybe that is just how he actually. But, I forgot about all this bit. I was never over keen on the first half of this, I must admit. I know you guys are a little more happy with the Doctorless sections, but.
I remember the first time I watched it that I would have preferred the Doctor was in it more. But I do have to admit, I think this is probably the strongest Christmas story we've had. Out of all of them, I can't think of another one.
I think it's a toss-up between this and Last Christmas, the episode Last Christmas.
Christmas was very good.
I think this. If there's anything that goes against this, it's possibly
anything of that story.
It's the one with Father Christmas.
Oh, God. You guys thought that one was good?
Yeah.
No offense?
I thought it was very good, yeah.
Okay.
It was very nicely done. It was well executed, and
I thought we all quite.
I thought we did as well, yeah. Maybe Brian's watched it twice. Decided he didn't like it the second time. But But this is such a strong episode still, even now, 11 years later.
I think what is interesting with this.
That's the thing.
Sorry.
Go on.
No, go on. No, you go on. No,
I was just going to say that's the thing with me watching these again. This is still basically an extension of season one because it aired the same year. You know, we always look at it as season two. It came out with the season two box set, but it's really, I mean, like it's coming off the heels of season one, and there was quite a gap between this and series two. So going back this far, this is completely rewatchable. It's an enjoyable story. Everything works in it. And I actually can kind of going back to that excitement angle that Christian was talking about, I can remember the excitement that I even had watching this. Whereas going with a lot of like later, like Moff era ones, I don't feel going back to revisit them that they're going to have aged quite as well, because they weren't even that great the first time round. And you know, I was going to sit here during this podcast and try not to say anything negative about Moff's era, but it's amazing when I watch these that these just resonate so well with me still, even now. And it harkens back now to how I feel about the classic series. But I don't get that sense with newer episodes.
Same time, there are things in this I don't like. I mean, I never liked the Christmas Santas. I never that, and the Christmas tree in this, obviously, which we'll get to shortly. They seem a little too, again, Christmas on the nose, which is perpetuated since. But everything else is good. I mean, their acting is, watching their acting is really, it's very, very good, this.
I have to say the tree scene is actually entertaining when you watch it, but I do agree I could have lived without the tree scene. I actually like the Santas. And I remember even when we get to the next Christmas special, the Runaway Bride, I remember thinking how cool it would have been. They missed a beat there for me, because they could have fixed the timeline in the show with the Runaway Bride if they wanted to very easily. Because my original thinking was, here we're going to find out that these Santas are those scavenger robots, which is what the Doctor called pilot fish, because something worse was coming. So they followed his Artron energy trail here that he's leaking, and they came. So now so are the Sycorax going to be following that. But he never really dealt with the pilot fish; like, they just kind of disappeared. So when we got the next one, when we got to the Runaway Bride and the pilot fish are back again, rather than have it be an entire year later and they're back there because of the Rachnos, I thought it would have been great if it was this Christmas again and the pilot fish were there and the Rachnos just used them, like took them and controlled them, kind of thing. Yeah, I would have loved that continuity, because it would have put the show back on a regular timeline and still allowed us to deal with something that was left hanging in this story. But you know, you can't have that thought watching this story the first time around. It's only something we can do in hindsight. But yeah, I thought that would have been great.
Yeah. So. No, I'm enjoying this more the second time around, I must admit, or third time, how many times I've seen this.
Yeah. And I agree, there are certain things watching this that I would still change. And some of the things come down to even the type of humor that's played. I think they're doing it a little bit better here with Mickey would have done with him previously. But there's always certain things in these newer shows. You know, our adult minds are going to sit there and try and make it more like what we want or what we are used to and kind of stuff. But just sitting back and watching it again, and like, I know we have to, if we don't think about this, we won't have anything to talk about. But if we sit here and try not to think of those things, it's really just an enjoyable story.
Oh, yeah, but I think that becomes the danger, doesn't it? As soon as you start saying, well, it's just an enjoyable Christmas story, you end up with this, you know, sort of listening of boring Christmas stories that we seem to get, where they're all focused around the festive. They're constantly sort of dinner time, Christmas fodder. But hell, you know, it's just a Christmas story. It's a bit of seasonal fun.
Well, I didn't say Christmas story, but I do agree with you. And I do, I have said for a long time that I think they should treat the Christmas stories just like a regular Doctor Who episode, not a Christmas story.
I mean, you could even have this at Christmas as it is, but you'd have, you know, robots and, you know, an attacking, I don't know, chair. I know that's not very exciting, and that would be the reason they would say, well, that's just not very interesting, is it? But the point being is it doesn't have to all fit around Christmas, because then you start creating this contrivance, which so it takes you a little out of it, because you know that it's there because it's Christmas and it's a Christmas special. It's like, why would they plant a Christmas tree? You know, why? It stretches things a bit.
Well, when you think about it, if you take this story and you keep this story just as is, it all does work. The Doctor lands and it's purposely here. It's Christmas time. They're disguising themselves as Santa Clauses. They made a Christmas tree a weapon. It all works in this story. But once a year, constantly having the doctor do something on Christmas on Earth each year, it does get a little old. And hey, maybe he does come back for Christmas each year, but there's always an alien invasion on it. Just, I agree. It shouldn't be that way. But one, certainly, or maybe one every once in a while would be fine. Or even if it was just more peripheral. What was the one? Voyage of the Damned. Voyage of the Damned was another good Christmas story because it was Christmas as a backdrop. Like, it was happening, but nothing was happening because it was Christmas. Like, it was just Christmas time on Earth, but this other event was happening in space just by chance. Unrelated to Christmas, rather. And I thought that was a good angle they finally did with that one. Go, we're still going to make it be Christmas here on Earth, but there's going to be no Christmas Santas and no Christmas presents that are the weapon. We're just going to, well, basically tell a movie again as a Doctor Who story. But all the same, they didn't stick to the whole Christmas theme in that one too terribly.
Interesting. I think I'll rewatch this after. There was a little music motif there, which just sounded like what they built the I Am the Doctor theme tune from. It was... don't know. Could have been. Anyway. Yeah, no, I think what was also interesting with this episode is that there is no genre in it. There's no sort of genre mocking, which obviously a lot of Christmas episodes tend to have, and obviously Doctor Who does a lot anyway. But I mean, I suppose it's the obvious, as you say, yeah, it's the alien invasion sort of episode, but it doesn't play like an alien invasion episode within the Doctor Who genre anyway.
It's definitely got shades of Ambassadors of Death about it, hasn't it? But not just the Mars thing, but the whole having a space program and something going wrong.
Yeah, sure.
But because there's no... well, I suppose there is a little, but there never feels like there's any direct conflict between Earth and the alien invasion that you'd sort of get in the Pertwee era, where you'd have soldiers having to defend against something. It's all sort of very much there and here.
Things always moved very quickly in that respect in classic Doctor Who, didn't they? You'd very quickly get from a status of peace to war like that. Mm. Whereas here, there's a lot of talking and a lot of negotiation, isn't there? Or attempted negotiation.
It's a good one for Mickey, as Brian was sort of alluding to.
Mm.
Oh, yes, I mean, that bit with the chair and the Christmas trees, where you're starting to see him come out of his shell a bit and be more than
it's
just
interesting when you watch these back. Oh, I'm sorry, James.
No, that was it.
For a Mickey standpoint, it's interesting when you watch these back, because a lot of people think that you know, series three, his change from, you know, coward to hero is just too quick and it makes no sense. They've been building it up very slowly throughout season one, even, and it's interesting to watch the stories back to notice that they've been putting it there. He's slowly not becoming that coward. He's getting more involved and he wants to do things, and it's very well handled by Noel once they got him out of that silly comedy aspect. There were a couple fumbles because, you know, Aliens of London, he does pretty well stepping up to be the hero, even though you can tell he's afraid to step in. He does it, but then they fumble back a little bit when you get to Boomtown and they make him be like the Marx Brothers Three Stooges comedy, you know. But then they pick it up again here very well. And certainly even in Parting of the Ways, when he helps Rose, you know, he just steps up to the bat and he doesn't, you know, he just knows this is what I have to do to help. And he does it.
And prior to Boomtown, he's very much like this Roy Castle in Chesterton, who will do heroic things, who will defend people.
Sure.
Equally, he will sort of run into walls and break things. And he's got that sort of temperament about him. Still a hero, but primarily an idiot. But also a hero, so you can play between the two.
Yeah.
Then they sort of shift away from that, as you say, quite wisely. Yeah.
I still think they could have done some good stuff with UNIT, and they just missed all the opportunities every time to even have like a regular supporting UNIT cast, because the amount of times they use them, they should have gotten a regular cast.
Well, I still think the problem was that UNIT was... well, you know, the original UNIT was not played like an army. It wasn't trying for that sort of realism. You know, well, in some ways, it obviously looked like one, but, you know, it was not. It was, and they obviously played it out as that as being this division which wasn't quite army. And they really missed that, I think, with UNIT in this season, which we've said before. They needed to look at UNIT and make it more of a sort of set cast, make them feel like more of a family, make them a little more... even if that wouldn't feel particularly realistic, they'd have no excuse since they did Torchwood, which was anything but, was like what UNIT did, but beyond it. There was lack of structure. There was a lack of feeling of... But you could have easily done a UNIT. Yeah, definitely you could have done a UNIT for today and done it without it being too stupid like Torchwood or too boring like this lot.
It is kind of funny, though, when you think about it, that they even made Torchwood, because everything that Torchwood did, outside of the, you know, adult aspects we talked about of the TV show, you could have done with UNIT. You didn't need Torchwood for it.
No. But I think the beautiful thing about what they did with UNIT, which they didn't do with Torchwood or they do with this UNIT, is that UNIT was sort of almost, it was very much like of its era, where you'd have a core set of cast. You could template this on Space 1999 or Star Trek, and then you could have expendables amongst those. You could go and encounter or have problems with alien threats. And so you feel you've got this bigger organization, but you've just got these key set main characters who you tend to follow and you are connected with. And they should have done that with Torchwood, and they should have done that with UNIT here. So, but you don't get any of that. Mm. And certainly with Torchwood, you end up thinking, you know, who's letting these people just do what they want with this massive amount of alien technology? It just seems absolutely ridiculous. It doesn't seem believable anyway. It's like a bat cave, an authorized bat cave in Cardiff, and it's not even like they do any good. They seem to just do more trouble than it's worth. Yeah, so yeah, UNIT would have been good.
The other issue I have with Torchwood is, obviously this is the, what is this, the first episode we're getting with any kind of actual Torchwood aspect to it. The issue with Torchwood is that they make it be born during Queen Victoria's era, and yet the Doctor has never heard of them, never encountered them until here, 2005, Christmas, and then... all of a sudden he can't stop hearing about them and you know, they go down to crime scenes and people are like, oh, bloody Torchwood's here. Yeah, just that secret group again, just like UNIT back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 60s, whatever they were. It's a shame. Like, I have no idea, no issue, with their creation of Torchwood. Like, even though I say it would have been better as just UNIT here, it's fine. I'm cool with it being a thing. But it would have been better if they had made it maybe have been formed perhaps in the gap year for Doctor Who. This way it would explain for at least the audience why the Doctors of the past have never come across Torchwood. And then maybe had the Doctor react to them a bit like the way he did with the Cult of Skaarow, where he heard about them, but he thought maybe they were just a rumor or something, you know? That probably would have made it work better. And that has nothing to do with Christmas Story.
I'm still thinking about how they do UNIT better. I was just trying to think of a way, if you could... Because I'm not saying that they should hark back to that old UNIT, but I think thinking of James Bond, and I'm thinking of sort of the Anglophile popularity. If you'd had a sort of UNIT that was connected to this universe, which was sort of quite small, quite old-fashioned in a sort of British way, possibly because the person running it, be a brigadier or general or whatever, is quite an old-fashioned British character who wants things in a certain way, and you could have fun with that. It could feel distinctly British, it could feel quite cozy, it could have characters that could relate and be, you know, and they've, you know, only, essentially duplicate what worked.
They've only got it right twice, and that's, you know, first time around. And I don't like specifically, I don't want to go into specifics of like the Charlton era and then the Pertwee era, but yeah, you know, like that UNIT then, and Remembrance of the Daleks.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're the only times they've got UNIT. Obviously, it wasn't UNIT, but, you know, it's a proxy UNIT. They're the only times they've got it right. The rest of the time, the casting, even in the Tom Baker era with UNIT, the casting's just been so way out. It just hasn't worked. There's been no charm about the lead characters. I'm not a fan of Gemma Redgrave as Kate Stewart. I think she phones it in, to be honest with you. She's not very good.
Battlefield was bad as well. That never worked for me either.
No. So. Yeah.
No, you're right. It's a shame too, because example.
What you could have done here, well, obviously during series one, is introduce UNIT as this military organization that is aware of alien threats, and you know they're here defending the Earth when in the absence of the Doctor, basically. But show them more militaristic now. The Brigadier is not there to control them. It's not a lax environment. You don't have the chummy kind of aspects of Benton or Yates or even Joe Grant. Just show them more as a military organization. Show the Doctor coming in. And, you know, basically everybody having to earn each other's trust and start to mellow UNIT out a little bit over time as they start to get used to working with companions and the Doctor. And that's because this particular version of UNIT hasn't seen the Doctor in a long time, you know, but that would have been better. Like, for instance, this story right here doesn't really need UNIT. If UNIT was thrown in as a nod for us to be excited that UNIT's in the story, all they needed was a military organization to be in it. And it's great that UNIT's there. But if you think about that, if you just put a military organization in, threw some UNIT patches on them and made them work like a military organization, the story would have worked fine. And as it does, basically. Which is, I guess, in essence, what they did do in this story. But my point is that if they made these characters carry over instead of every time we see UNIT, it's a new cast of characters, we would have had a more of a vested interest in UNIT. And it seems like they want to throw it in as a nod to us, as something for us to get excited about, as I said, but they don't want us to remain excited about UNIT. They just want to use it as an excitement tool whenever they want us to get excited about it, rather than have there be any familiarity there, which is a shame, because with the way that they ground this show with Rose's family or even Martha's family or with the aspects of Amy and Rory's life that are grounding them here and Jenna Coleman, Clara, they could have done the same thing with UNIT. You could have replaced coming to Earth and seeing family members at a certain point or every so many episodes at least to see this UNIT family, even if they don't act as much of a family as the old one did in the classic series. It would have taken us away from always constantly going back to the companion's house. And that could have been a nice little reprieve, and maybe we would have gotten a break like that, and Earth would have felt more refreshed. Earth stories, rather, would have felt more refreshed. I like this aspect too. I mean, getting back, I guess, to this point, and I know we don't really know what's going on right now, but the whole blood control aspect, it's absurd, but it's fun. It's that's what Doctor Who does in my eyes. You know, they make the absurd, like so much in the classic series was absurd, but they make it happen, and it's an alien science you wouldn't get in another show, you know?
Is the Tower of London that close to the Gherkin?
It could be the type of lens.
Oh.
I don't know.
I don't know. I've never actually. I've been to London many times, and I've never been to the Tower of London.
No, Gherkin isn't that close, but then like,
I just wonder if it's been if they're not actually at the Tower of London, and whether they've just stuck.
That would make more sense.
Everyone else, you know, the way I'm so surprised no one's done this. The way the Sycorax are arranged on screen. I'm so surprised no one's actually made a spoof Bohemian Rhapsody video based around the way that, because they're stood in the same way as Queen are at the beginning of Bohemian Rhapsody with sort of a diamond.
And that was deliberate. That
it's got to have been,
yeah. But you're right. Why no one has taken it a step further?
Are we sure they haven't?
Well, I haven't.
Good
seen
question.
It. I haven't seen it.
For some reason, when I first saw the story, I thought Sally was going to become somebody like in the show. I didn't think she was just going to be a one-off character for the story. I thought they were building her up, either not a companion replacement, but perhaps a secondary companion.
Yeah.
This Welsh guy with the Delgado-esque beard.
Yeah.
He's. I've only ever seen him in two things, this and an episode of Midsummer Murders. Never seen him in anything ever.
That's probably because they're the only two shows you tend to watch. It's probably been in everything else, bar class.
That's not strictly true.
You come to the assumption. Yes. I mean, I quite like this. I quite like the deduction. But again, if you had a nice set of characters. And maybe also the set is just too decentralized, too drab. It's too real, maybe, or not real. It just doesn't have any sort of feeling of where you are.
We were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. It's a bit James Bond.
It's too James Bond, yeah. And I think they did make it really miss out on trying to sort of do something with this sort of type of people. And I think people would like that. I mean, the beautiful thing is if you can make characters out of expositional positions, you're on a gravy train. It means that you can bring characters back into the show when you need to. You don't have to think how to weave them into the story because they're really just expositional with hopefully charming people playing them.
Yeah. Actually, so, you know, it is very James Bond. It's just struck me. She's M.
Yeah.
And the beardy guy is Q. And the general chap there, he's Colin Salmon or Michael Kitchener's characters, the chief of staffs. That's essentially what's just happened there. It's James Bond.
But it needs to be something. Again, it's always down to the characters, isn't it? I mean, you think of even back to UNIT with Benton and Yates. Very rarely had any lines, especially initially, that were of great character relevance. They were just walking plot use.
Was that one where they're watching the rugby? That's the demons, isn't it?
Plot pieces, yes. And there's obviously the Time Monster. There's some nice little bits for Benton in that. But by and large, they are just like the Star Trek crew. You know,
I'm sure that wasn't a... it's just nice little bits for Benton. Benton who ends up naked and a child.
Well, if you want to go down that route, you can down yourself. But he had something to do there. And you get some nice little scenes like in the Day of the Daleks where, you know, Yates steals the food. But they're just there because they're useful for the plot. And then you make little moments out of them because they're people that people have got to come to like. Yeah. And
this is a good moment. The timing of this is excellent.
Yes.
You know, I will say one good thing that this story did that I still love, and you know, people can say whatever they want about all the new series companions, but it actually showed. Well, I'm going to have to go to a Moffat story here. I'm going to go to Flatline, I guess.
Yeah.
When Clara became the doctor, when the doctor was there, but just trapped inside the TARDIS, but could still communicate with her, Clara still did all the doctory things on her own. Whereas here, the doctor is unconscious and Rose doesn't know what to do. And we'll even get to a bit in the end when she actually does try. She tries her best going, you know, like he's out of commission. We have to try and defend. I will defend the way he did. And we can see that she's not that great at it. And it's good because she's trying and she's trying to do the right thing. She's standing up to the evil, but she just can't do it the same way as him because clearly she doesn't have all the intelligence that he has throughout the years of doing what he has. And when I say intelligence, I mean intelligence in the respect of compiled information. She's not a smart person, but it's great because we're getting to see the desperation of this world right now in this massive face of disaster, which, of course, if the doctor wasn't there, Torchwood would have taken care of the situation without whatever he had done. We now know that from the end of the story. But it was a great moment just to show Rose is learning, but she's not the doctor yet, or, you know, or she's not going to be that person just yet. Whereas, you know, Clara, all she needs to do is just, you know, oh, he's not there. Don't worry. I got this anyway. What have I done? I've just traveled with him for a few times. It just didn't work as well later on. Here, it was so much better, much better handled. So much more truthful.
Yeah.
I love that terrible line that she has that, you know, I've seen all these things with him, but when I'm stuck at home, I'm useless. Like, no, you'd be stuck. You'd be useless as well out there, too. The common denominator here is him and he's out of commission. Wherever he's out of commission, you're going to be useless. You know, you've not got any superpowers, love. But no,
I like the fact, though, when you think about it, though, the two, it's actually even showing how well they work as a pair, because we've seen obviously throughout series one and series two with Rose that if Rose wasn't there, the doctor could have been dead many times over as well, you know, because there wasn't that helping hand. But yeah, absolutely. You're right. You know, if she were anywhere else and the doctor wasn't there, she would be useless without him. I like that little touch, by the way.
That's the point, isn't it?
Big Ben was under repair.
Yeah, I like that as well. I like the way that they sort of push that in the sense that, you know, it depowers her and that sort of makes her more real and it gives more drive to the story, that you don't feel. And I like that idea. It feels almost, again, like Unit, in that sort of sense that, you know, it's an alien invasion. It's not like Unit, it's sort of like Quatermass, all those sort of alien invasion stories of the 60s and 70s, 60s and 70s, where all you can do is try and survive. You know, if you've not got the power, you've got to go and hide. I suppose it's sort of World War syndrome. And her first honest reaction is not to try and solve this, is to try and protect her friends and the Doctor. Get into the TARDIS, we will hide, we'll be safe. And then I don't know, but that is the logical next step.
You know, that's great. It is very like Dalek invasion of Earth kind of aspect, where everybody's just out there surviving on their own.
Yeah.
Before trying to deal with it. And you don't, it's amazing. Just hearing you say that, you don't really get that very often in the new series. It's generally, we've got to hang on this, you know, and we're going to take care of it. You know, occasionally you would get it in maybe a two-parter like Rise of the Cybermen or something like that. But ordinarily, in this one-hour long story, it's probably the closest we've come to a past Doctor Who story where things can get bleak and then we have to come back up from them again. I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense, because every story's got to go bleak at some point, even if the Doctor is on top of things. But it's really showing a lot of them getting invested in what's going on around them, more so than just kind of hanging on the boot heels of the Doctor. I like this bit with Jackie too, packing for the TARDIS. I mean, it makes sense. You're going to have to survive in there. She doesn't know what they've got, but she's a classic mom in that respect.
Yeah.
Here's the thing with building up Unit, or rather having Unit characters but not having regulars. You know, they kill these two characters in this scene, and I guess we're meant to feel something for their death, whereas their deaths feel as pointless as like the people we see getting pecked off on the streets by Daleks. You know, we don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. Like, not that I would want to see a cool regular character die, but sometimes you do need that to feel the emotion. And these guys, they just didn't do much to endear us to them, or endear them to us.
Yeah.
And I like him, that Colonel character, which is a shame. It would have been nice if he would have stuck around and, like I said, been one of those continuing characters.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a shame. Yeah, it's a good TARDIS scene as well, this, with the I don't know. I also like the, you were saying about Jackie preparing, you know, bringing everything. It's like one of those nightmares where you sort of have to sort of try and get away from something very quickly, and you're either too busy packing your case and you can't find the right things, or, you know, imagine the end of the world and you're trying to get away and one of your family is there still trying to bring everything.
Yeah.
There's a sort of truth to that sort of tension.
Good angle, too. I like that shot through the broken window.
Oh, dear. Quick, get back inside.
Yeah, I think it's a shame that she wasn't.
That who wasn't what?
The Jackie got left behind.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah, some nice moments in this. Again, I keep saying that, but I like the script. Suppose. Is this is the first time Mickey sort of comes off? Well, I suppose he's not off world.
Yeah, it's the first time he's travelled in the TARDIS, isn't it? Well, he hasn't really travelled in the TARDIS either.
No. I know we were saying it earlier, and while I've never been a massive fan of the new series Police Boxes, that one is still so much better than the blue.
You know, we've got all the way through this, and we've missed all the "we know who you are" jokes.
I know.
Shame.
I was thinking that. I didn't know whether to mention them or not, because occasionally, I remember at the time, I found them quite amusing.
Oh, they are. They are good, especially when the aliens do it.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to mention it earlier that in Journey's End, when she says it to the Daleks and yes! they say it to her, it's one of those things where you're like, this should be annoying by now, but I'm so glad they did that at the same time. It's crazy how annoying it could be, but it worked. And it's one of those jokes that it's just like, no, I'm going to let that go because that's funny. That's still good. Like, if you have that moment, you take that moment.
Stuart Lee does that that piece, that bit where he talks about the idea of taking a joke, where you see something and the first time it's funny, the next time it's really hilarious, the time after that you can't stop laughing, and then after that it becomes not so funny anymore, and then it becomes slightly irritating, but then you push it far enough it becomes funny again. Mm. Which he says pretty much the basis of his entire method of sitcom for the last several decades, which is true.
Sorry, who was this?
Stuart Lee.
Oh, right, okay.
He's specifically, contextually, he's referencing someone defacing a load of signs to the town shill bottle to shit bottle.
Right.
And, you know, driving past it, he would notice, you know, the first time it would be funny, second one, still funny. But by the time you get to your sixth one, as you're getting closer, it's no longer funny. But by the time you get to the eighth, it's come funny again. Mm. And it's like...
That's the only time that sort of thing works.
And for some reason, this does.
The only time that sort of repetition didn't work for me was when I worked on a film one time, and the director, every time he called cut and liked a take, instead of saying excellent, he said excrement.
Oh. Yeah.
And it wasn't funny the first time.
That's the problem.
So it wasn't funny any subsequent times.
Yeah. That is the core issue with that joke. It has to be funny at least the first time, or at least have the potential to be funny. But we've been missing this fun scene. Rose out of her element, which is very pleased. It's funny how the show just forgot about this. You know, there's nothing wrong in having companions which are out of their element. It doesn't belittle her. It doesn't belittle her bravery, her power.
Exactly. They're showing how strong she has become here, in that she's going to stand up to them no matter what. And that's great. Like, rather than... Once they can stand up to the aliens and take care of the aliens on their own, then it's a little too unbelievable for me, because I just don't feel any of us humans can actually do that. There's ways maybe we can trick a handful of them or stop them, fine. But this is an entire army of them. You're in their spaceship and you're going to find the words to make them leave. Like, this works so well because of it actually not working for her. But it shows so much more character than taking another companion and making them be able to ward off the aliens just with their words, like Clara, like having her be the doctor in Flatline. This works so much better for character aspects. It does so much more for Rose.
It's a very good scene, the entire scene, actually.
Mm-hmm. Can we just have a quick talk about the translator on the TARDIS? I've never minded the idea that the TARDIS is the sort of hub of translation, even though that has had times where there are questions surrounding it, where they go to places where no longer the TARDIS is around. But this whole thing that the Doctor seems to have that sort of relationship to the translation, does that work?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it works for this story, doesn't it? But
obviously,
Maybe it's because he's just regenerated. He can use the excuse that he just regenerated, so it isn't working properly until he wakes up and regenerated.
Maybe the tea cured the TARDIS, which had a damage when it came down with a big thump.
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, I think it goes back to the Android Invasion. Because Tom knew that Sarah wasn't Sarah, because she asked how she can understand the aliens when they're talking. And he said, that's how I knew it wasn't you, because you've never asked that me before. And then he told her, it's a time or a gift that I allow you to share.
Yeah,
so it does make it sound like what they're doing here with the TARDIS actually being the translator, but the Doctor being the conduit for it.
But that's what I mean.
Some kind of telepathic power. That does seem to work. It goes with the continuity they've laid out.
But does it with all the continuity? That's what I'm saying. Are there occasions where the Doctor was...
There's nothing.
That's the problem.
It's Doctor Who.
I mean, obviously,
yeah, there's, but there's no continuity in the show that works entirely. I feel like they always, if the writer needs to do something in a story and they're going to bypass continuity to do it, they'll do it. And if other writers just write a story and no one picks up on the continuity error, it happens, you know. And it's a shame. I would love for it all to make sense, but no, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense with everything. It makes for a great moment here because I do like that. That's, we're all instantly aware that the Doctor is awake in that moment. So it actually sells very well here, but in other stories, probably not for sure. But that's the thing. That's how they keep writing these new series stories. Russell had to break continuity a few times just to get the story that he wanted across. Moss does it all the time, and it's a shame. But it does work here, I think.
Yeah, this is a good scene. It's just a pity that New Earth didn't follow through with this same sort of energy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's an aggression to it, which is not present in New Earth. He seems fairly
New
bored.
Earth. What a fantastic episode that is. I'm being sarcastic, just in case you didn't realize. Yeah.
I honestly don't mind New Earth quite as much as others, but there are aspects that really just annoy the hell out of me. And one of them is the whole Russell trying to capitalize on Moth's everybody lives moment and trying to recreate it of his own. You know, it just doesn't work. It doesn't sell. But there are other aspects that certainly don't work in that story. But let's just say there are worse stories. Love Moth. What?
Hmm?
What? Nothing.
Which story?
No, but you're Love and Monster.
No. I thought you were going to refer to
the name one.
The eye jam episode.
Oh, God. Jesus. If there's a story that I could say is worse than Love and Monsters, I think you've just nailed it.
Which one is this?
I can't even remember what it's called. The Sandman one.
Oh, God, yes.
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 That's how memorable that one is.
I do think they did, you know, having the 10th Doctor lick things, I thought was hilarious. I thought that was a great aspect, and I understand why they had to write it out because kids were licking things. But you would have thought this story alone, the very first time he ever licked anything to tell what it was, being blood, would have been something that someone, some censor somewhere might have said, hey, you know what? Maybe you guys should write that bit out. Because if anything was going to get them to stop making him lick things, I would have thought that was it. You know, licking an old radio or a TV box, you know, fine, whatever, who cares? That's an inanimate object, you know, but that may just have germs on it. But that is a little weird. Good though, because like I said, I love that. What doctor has done that? It's great. Like, I love the fact that Tom Baker can take his spoon out and you know, tap it on a shell and lick the spoon and like tell what's going on. I thought that was kind of funny, but you know, this is a whole new level. But unfortunately, impressionable children.
The sword fighting's good. It's we've really only got one of the dots. Did Peter Davison do some sword fighting or not?
Or King's Demons?
Hmm?
No, was it
King's Demons? Yeah,
yeah, was no, some... King's it was Demons. King's Demons. Yeah,
yeah, and then there's obviously there's one between the Master and Pertwee, isn't there?
And of course, Davison was almost beheaded twice, which I was, at the time thought was bizarre as a kid. Visitation and Fort of Doomsday.
Oh, Fort of Doomsday, yeah.
Not again. It's kind of weird why they wrote that in, because I love it. But it's sort of real sort of, I don't know, sort of in reference, which you just don't really get in those sort of periods. Sort of almost like sort of postmodern sort of nod to the repetition, and that in itself becomes the joke. I think it's a bloody hand.
Oh, what was going through my mind at this point in 2005 was, are they going to have a doctor with just one hand? Wow,
really?
That's brave. Yeah. How have you made this last?
I have no idea what is off with our sync today, but you guys are at the hand cutting scene. I'm just starting the sword fight.
I noticed that, and I was thinking, have you got a? Is either there must be a cut on yours, your version. There's got to be something cut, because even different
cut,
sort of slight speeds.
Extended.
I wonder if ours is the extended one then, and yours isn't.
I'm watching the DVD.
No, mine would have to be extended because I'm behind you.
I'm on the DVD.
Oh yeah, good point. Yeah, I'm on the DVD as well. No, I'm on Netflix. Blu-ray. I'm on Netflix, but I'm at the same point as Christian, by and large. Right.
So I mean, and this is great. I'm sure this is great so for the riveting for our listeners right now. But where are you at? You just cut his hand off?
Yeah, now they're fighting.
He's pinched the sword off the Sycorax. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that is fascinating. Why? Because that's a massive gap. We're talking about
that's huge. Yeah,
70 seconds, 80 seconds or so, at least.
Is there a known cut in this for US us? Viewers?
No, it's for us. If there was a cut, because we're ahead.
Oh right, yeah. Strange.
So that is bizarre.
Maybe we just watch things at different speed in the UK.
Well, you know, I was wondering still a that massive... because your film is at different speed, but
I know, but you're still talking about
speed difference.
Yeah, that's exactly. You're talking massive. Yeah. Have you got to the hand cutting yet? We're at very Arthur Dent now.
Well, I'm skipping now. I'm skipping ahead, so I'm just at the hand. I'm at Rose tossing him the sword.
Well, we're past now.
I wonder where our listeners are. I wonder if they're with me or you guys, and if they're enjoying this bit of the podcast.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that as well. Perhaps our listener can tell us where they are at this point as well.
I would love to know if anybody actually knows of any differences between the British and the.
I'm beginning to wonder, but I can't imagine you'd have a better fuller cut than us. But you must have been at least about a minute behind.
A minute, yeah.
Yeah, I certainly the remote that I'm using has a 10-second skip ahead, and I've hit it. I can't tell you how many times. At least 70 seconds. See, I just got to the no second chances. That's so weird.
Yeah, it was a good arc, the Tenant arc. I've never had the issue with the sort of emo thing they keep talking about.
No,
it's kind of fun the way that, although yeah, I think we've all agreed we all disliked this season series particular for the chumminess between him and Rose, but
certainly when you get to a story which I love and watch quite often, to be honest, but Rise of Cybermen, that story arc, dislike the beginning, the way that they treat Mickey. I just don't see it for either one of them. And I understand that Rose is a little annoyed that he's there, but they could have played that better. It's a shame.
It's horrid, isn't it? It's the first time you suddenly feel that the Doctor's delight. It's like a school. I think what got me is that you've got kids watching this at school, and it is schoolyard. You know, these two people get on very well. The other person doesn't really fit, but, you know, they're not going to actually sort of really acknowledge that. They're just going to pretend he almost like he doesn't exist. And that's so schoolyard. You don't want the Doctor doing that.
No. I'll be so honest weak? And say, I didn't mind when he had no idea that Mickey was still holding the button. I thought that was kind of funny, but it was their reactions to him and their story and always ignoring him and that stuff. Like, if it was just a silly gag with, like, why are you still holding that? Like Mickey's being the novice to the ship, essentially. I could buy that, but their attitudes otherwise, it was so wrong. I agree with you too. You wouldn't get that with, I don't know. I guess you would get that with certain children, and maybe that's what it is. It's too childlike for me, you know?
Well, it just gave her too much power again as well. And just weakened him because he just throughout that whole story felt like he was just doing whatever she wanted. She wanted to go and see her dad, even though it'd have massive repercussions to the timeline. He goes and follows her. And there's that horrible situation where Mickey says, you know, we know which one of us you're going to go and follow. And he does. And that's not that. You'd want it to be the other way around. You want the Doctor to surprise you and go, no, she'll be fine. I'm going to come with you, which obviously the story wouldn't allow. But that's what you're wanting at that moment.
It would have even been interesting, too, if he did go with Rose, but all the while had tabs on Mickey, like all those years traveling in space. He had ways to keep up with his friends, and that would have been a great aspect where Mickey's like, oh, it's never going to be me, right? And then the Doctor can tell him, like, hey, you went to go visit your grandmother, you know, I'm following you, I'm keeping up with you, I'm making sure you're safe. And that would have been a great aspect. And then even later on, you could deal with the ramifications of that you can't always keep them safe. You may know where they are, but you can't always keep them safe. And that would have worked too. There's it. So I agree, like what you were saying earlier in this story, that there are certain things that you would have liked to see different, or certain things you would have changed. And I feel that way about every new series story. I don't think any new series story has hit the mark perfectly, but But I think that's also the same with anything that I've ever liked as a child that they're making new now. New Star Wars, all the Marvel films, the Indiana Jones film, anything that I have had a complete grasp of. And I feel, in many ways, we feel we know the characters and what they would do better than the people making the new shows. And, you know, maybe Russell knows Rose better than us, fine. But we know the Doctor, you know, and it's very uncharacteristic, some of the things that they made him do. This story, I think, is pretty good, but then he's in it for such a short time. It's very, very difficult to take him out of his Doctor aspect.
I think perhaps one of the problems that comes, and I imagine this is for Russell and Moffat and most long-term writers, is you become connected to your characters in a way that you don't see them like other people do. And I've always got the impression, right, like with Rose, he saw Rose as being something far more special. And I think Clara suffered from that as well with Moffat, where they start seeing them as being something more brilliant than the author, than the people beyond see them. They become too connected to them. And they don't realize that other people see them in a different way. And maybe they don't catch on to that till later. And things like Mickey, perhaps, is an example of that. Maybe they thought, you know, because people love Rose as much as he loves Rose, when Rose and the Doctor are laughing and Mickey's left out, people will find that funny because they're connected to Doctor and Rose, and Mickey's the comedy character. Well, I think when people watched it, more of the feeling was, this feels like they're having an inside joke and I'm left out alongside Mickey. We're ostracized from the Doctor, and I don't like that. Although maybe he'd have just said, maybe that was his setup for the whole idea again of the Doctor and Rose getting their comeuppance at the end of the season. You know, that they become so enamored with each other that they no longer connect with other people, that would have possibly to stop.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the intent, but... Oh, and we've got the clothes scene.
Yeah, the whole don't you think she looks tired? It's really clever. It's persisted beyond this, hasn't it? Back into where it came from, really, because it recalled Thatcher's departure, didn't it? In 1990, 91, 90, and then it's kind of come back into parlance. It's still referred to, which is nice.
I'm finding this kind of sad because it's actually giving me those resonances of 2005. I'm now remembering being back there, you know, where some relatives were healthier, you know, that you were younger, that you didn't have the dismal situations of, you know, well, obviously there's always corruption, but, you know, the world just seems a very confusing place now. And that's not from me being young. I was still fairly old in 2005. But now the world seems so much more confusing and so much more lacking innocence than it did
too
then, in a weird way.
Noise.
Yeah, it's...
In my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too much noise.
Yeah, I'm with you.
That's it. It's not about any particular political point there. It's just, it feels like there's just too much noise and... just no one can see anything straight anymore, including bookies. You know, bookies have got so many things wrong these last 16 months, 18 months, that it makes you think, you know, no one can see anything anymore. There's just too much noise that people can't think straight. And it's, this seems like such a simpler time.
I used to have a TV like that. It looks so old now.
I know, doesn't it? I was thinking back to that shop, you know, of his wardrobe. I think how many times I saw that on Outpost Gallifrey, people picking through it, trying to find all the outfits. And that just seems such a simpler time.
Yeah.
I do want to give mention here, and I know it's a little sometimes out of place in Doctor Who for us still, but that song that they play during his changing scene.
Yeah.
I like that. And I know it was specifically written, and there were songs pertaining to Rose and the Doctor, or lyrics pertaining to the Doctor and Rose's relationship and so on. But I like that song. I like the feel that it puts, especially being a Christmas episode, and I liked the aspect of it. But the one thing that bugged me is later on when the soundtrack came out, released by Murray Gold, instead of releasing that version that we knew, they re-recorded it with a completely different vocalist.
Neil Hanlon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it bugged me. It was just like, why? It was good. I want it as it was in the show.
I think it was to say it was Neil Hanlon still, wasn't it? It was just different. They remixed, they redid it for the... Because they did the same
vocalist.
No.
Oh, was it?
It was a different
vocalist. Wasn't it Murray Gold?
Because, no, it wasn't. Murray Gold had a friend of his sing it for the episode. And then when they recorded it for the album, they got that Neil.
Neil Hammond's from the Divine Comedy, Brian. who you may have heard of. You'd probably enjoy them, actually, because it's quite kind of eclectic.
Did Father Ted theme tune.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, it's quite an eclectic mix of songs. You may enjoy it.
But they did that. It's frustrating. I remember at one of the Royal Albert Hall ones that they did that. It was what was the song they did for the next Christmas special, which Hannon did, and that was much better at the Albert Hall than it was actually on the soundtrack as well. I remember being disappointed with that. Just felt a bit flat and drab there, but it had sort of a bit of a spark when it was done live.
That is a problem with music in general, though. Quite often it can sound flat on vinyl or in the studio, can't it, compared to live?
Trying to find this one here.
If only they'd gone to Barcelona.
So this says Neil Hannon re-recorded it for the soundtrack, but I'm trying to figure out who the heck originally sung it.
There you go. And then a trailer for Series 2 of Doctor Who.
Awkward end for Mickey there.
Let me tell you what's crazy here. I've basically got myself caught up to you guys, but I'm still the Doctor pointing at the sky of where they're going to go.
So there must be something to do with the speed.
Must be.
God, maybe time is just a bit slower over there.
Well, it's weird, though. I don't remember being this far off before.
No, I don't either. Maybe something timey-wimey is actually taking place right now.
But it is interesting that me and you, Christian, have sort of remained pretty much in sync, despite we're using different...
We're in the same time zone, though. And we're in more or less a line with each other as well.
But you're on DVD and I'm on Netflix as well.
Oh, yeah, I know. But, you know, geographically speaking, we're more or less in the same place.
But he's in the same place so far as his conversation isn't out. He's in tandem with us vocally. It's his Blu-ray, which seems to be very
Well, there's only one person we can call, and that's the Doctor.
No. Steve Malone, he's got enough on his plate these days. Failing, fledging ratings and all that sort of thing.
He's far too grumpy for the likes of us. So, the Christmas Invasion. Any final thoughts?
Oh, yeah. Isn't this the first one to have the end credits actually done orchestral?
Yeah, I think it was.
It's the first one.
Yeah, I remember that because it brought back that middle section.
Yeah, and it reverts the character to the Doctor as well, doesn't it? He's been Doctor Who throughout season
one. Yes, because that was David Tennant. He made them do that.
Yeah.
He said that, you know, that's how he should be credited. So, yeah, good point. So, yeah, those are my final thoughts. I enjoy it. I always enjoy the Christmas Invasion. I remember for some reason, I think the first time I saw it, I was bummed the Doctor wasn't in it more.
Yeah,
and
like that.
Then the second time I saw it, I really liked it. So it was, I don't know if it's one of those growers or if it was just the fact that trying to get used to a Doctor Who episode without the Doctor took a little time. But concept-wise, it was dead on. It was a great way to introduce him by showing what the world would be like without him. And then once you bring him in, in essence, I guess they did the same thing with Pertwee for a long time. We got to watch what that world was like without him for quite a while after coming off the heels of Troughton. But it makes a lot of sense. Rather than just going straight into a new guy, which you know half of the audience are going to hate off of the bat just because it's not the old guy. And then like two, three episodes later, they're going to be like, oh, no, they're okay. It was great to remove them from so much of the story and then bring them in. They have much more of an impact. And somehow, I don't know if you can relate to them more, if that's the right way to say it, or just more so, they're more interesting to you as a new person rather than they would be if they were just being the Doctor taking up the boots of the previous person. So it seems like it was probably just quite a wise move to do, but difficult to do every time as a format.
Yeah, I
just can't. I know he's got a couple of little niggly things that you maybe would like to change, but on the whole, it's a really good Doctor Who. It's a really good Christmas special. It introduces a new Doctor well. As we said earlier on, it's a Christmas special that stands up so well today, 11 years later. I'd be happy with that as a new episode. I'd be happy to watch that on Christmas Day, possibly instead of what we're going to get on Christmas Day.
I think my issues are mainly the overuse of Christmas. The Christmas tree just feels a little forced in there. It'd been okay in an Auton episode, but it didn't really feel like it fitted. And the unit people are all just a little bit charmless. But other than that, yeah, it's fun.
Definitely fun. Fun in Doctor Who. When did we last have that?
I doubt it'll be this Christmas.
Sadly, we will see. We will see. That's our commentary. We hope you enjoyed it. And share your reflections and memories and observations, whether you were watched along with us. Let us know if it went timey-wimey for you as well. Or if you've listened in the car, let us know. We'll be back. We will be back. And I'm just looking at the date. We'll be back. I think we'll be back in the new year. So until then, it's goodbye.